On this fourth day of January 2011 in San Diego, we are reading from the Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. We are in Chapter 7 entitled Knowledge of the Absolute, text number 11. Balam balavatam chaham kamaraga vivarjitam dharmavarudho bhuteshu Kamosmi Bharatarshaba. Translation, I am the strength of the strong, devoid of passion and desire. I am sex life which is not contrary to religious principles, O Lord of the Bharatas, Arjuna. Purport. The strong man's strength should be applied to protect the weak, not for personal aggression. Similarly, sex life, according to religious principles, dharma, should be for the propagation of children, not otherwise. The responsibility of parents is then to make their offspring Krishna conscious. Om Jnana Timarandasya Jnanandana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilatam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisance to him and all members of Sri Parampara. So Krishna is continuing his description here of how he is manifest in this material world. One of the first principles of bhakti yoga, or acquiring divine consciousness, is to begin to see God in everything. This is a general principle of the saintly life, is to see the presence of the Lord in everyone and in everything. We were also discussing this in the morning. So, since what we know, you have to begin from where you're at. Just like any teacher, you have to start from where the students are. You can't start teaching higher mathematics if they don't know arithmetic yet. So you have to know where your students are. So in this world, everyone is absorbed in the things that we're surrounded by. So that's where Krishna is beginning. Everyone has some strength. That strength, especially when of the strong, that's myself. That's part of my energy. But he's describing here, as Prabhupada mentions in the purport, a righteous application of strength. This is especially applies to what is known as the Kshatriyas. The Kshatriyas are a social class who are warrior castes. They're natural leaders, what we would call charisma. They're natural leaders of people, leadership qualities, and other qualities. But they have to apply strength. They have to apply force to maintain dharma within the society, for the protection of the weak, for the protection of the Brahmins, the older people, children, women, the weaker section of society, or just people in general need protection from the inevitable class of rogues and thieves and those who would do ill. So Kshatriya class has to be there. But here, a very important thing. I am the strength of the Kshatriyas, devoid of personal desire, raga, kama, raga, vivarjitam. And not that when this force is misused and they become an oppressive force in the world. And we see that even in the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam tells about kings like that. King Vaina is very famous for that. He was the father of Prithu, who was the most righteous king. But anyway, there's a whole story about how that came about. But he, even back in the old Vedic age, you know, he was just rascal number one. He stopped all of the sacrifices. He was oppressing the Brahmins and the devotees. And eventually he was dethroned. The Brahmins got together and used their brahminical power to kill him, execute him. And Prithu was born. And in the 12th canto, it's described many, many kings and leaders in this age, gradually they become oppressive. They become despots, not proper kings. So that always happens. And when there are those who can curb this evil in society, and it's applied with detachment, just like even in our present day society, there's the police, the justice, the judicial system. They're supposed to be nonpartisan. They're supposed to be blind, right? The lady is blind. She doesn't take favors. So that's the proper application of force. But in the present day, it becomes corrupted. The judges get bought off. The police can become corrupted. So that kind of strength is not identified with Krishna. Now, the second part of the verse deals with sex life. This is another aspect of life that is all around us. But here, the point is that Krishna is identifying himself with that kama, or sex, which is not against religious principles. So we have to know what those religious principles are. Otherwise, we get swept away in the waves of material desire, beginning with sex. And Krishna makes it very clear in the end of the third chapter that this is the real enemy of the living being. This is the source of all kinds of problems in this world. People are controlled by this ever-expanding desire for sex and other principles of personal pleasure. So Prabhupada makes the point in this purport. It's a short purport, but he says the purpose of sex in religious marriage is for propagation of good children. So that means there are certain times, there are certain ways it's to be done, the frequency, which we won't get into details here. But otherwise, if you let this kama can burn. It's like a fire that burns out of control, and it covers any kind of spiritual knowledge. This is very clear at the end of the third chapter. The very telling verse in the. Let's see if I got this one right. I was just looking at it today. Krishna's Kaviraj, one of our great acharyas, our great leaders or our teachers. He describes the difference between lust and love. Many people conflate the two. Conflate means to confuse the two. You know, lust and love. So he says like this: Atmendriya priti vancha, tare boli kam. Krishnendriya priti icha, tare prem nam. So the icha and vancha are basically the same idea, desire. So both are desires. One is prema, pure love for God, and the other is kama, which is the root downward, is the degradation of the soul. So the definition is this. The desires to satisfy one's own senses, that's kama. And the desire to satisfy Krishna's senses is prema. Same idea. The desire to satisfy the senses is there, but one is to serve and to please the senses of God, and another is to please our own senses. Because scientifically, you know, but the Krishna consciousness is the science. We're faced with a problem. You know, if we don't do anything, if we just lead an ordinary life like everyone leads, you know, without even thinking about these things, then we have a problem. So many problems. But the main problem is we're getting older, you know, eventually we'll get sick and we'll die, you know. And people put that problem out of their mind. They think, well, I can't do anything about it, so let's deal with the other problems. But the Vedic teachers are, yes, you can. That is our main problem. And it doesn't just happen once. Then you're reborn again and you go around and around. We're in total ignorance of our main problems. And so we're dealing with little sub-problems, trying to deal with them anyway, by material means. And failing miserably, you know. Yeah, I don't know how many of you have ever been really sick. I remember when I was how old was I? In 69, you know, 22 or so. I had a serious case of hepatitis. It wasn't hepatitis C, but it was serious. It took me in the hospital for a month. I was in there with hepatitis, and you know, when you're in that situation, your regular life is suspended. Right? And all of those things that you thought were important and you were excited about, it kind of just bleeds away. And the one thing that you're really excited about is getting out of this hospital bed. You know? It all kind of comes down to that. You know? And even if you just laid up for a week with the flu or something, your whole perspective changes. You can't do all those things you used to be able to do, you know, you were able to do in your healthy life. And your whole focus is on getting rid of the illness. You know, and eventually that happens to everybody. You know, what's the use of your great plans for, you know, making money or doing this or going here or going there, when you're at death's door from some disease? You see, it all comes down to that. So really, that's our problem. These other things are just distractions. If we can solve that problem, if we can solve the death problem, you know, then that's the. The whole ball of wax is right there, you know. So that's what this is all about. And so now, what is it that prevents us from from thinking about this and dealing with these. First of all, we don't know that there is a solution because we're ignorant. But even if we were to become philosophical, and you know, many philosophies, they deal with these things and they try to integrate, well, what's the meaning of life, you know, because we all have to die and all these things. But they have no idea really about what's going on. So what covers us and makes us forget about these important problems, old age, disease, death, rebirth, you know, is kama, material desire. Avritam gyanam etena gyanino nityavaitana. Krishna describes in the third chapter that avritam means to cover. We are the knower. We're the gyani. Gyani means a possessor of knowledge. But right now, most of our knowledge is covered over. There's so many things in our minds that we don't access, that we experience. And deep down inside, we know the truth of who is God, who we are, what the relationship is, you know, how we should act. But that's all forgotten in the phantasmagoria of trying to enjoy in this world. That's called kama. So Krishna says, avritam gyanam eta. Gyanam is knowledge. It covers our knowledge. Gyanina nityavairina, the eternal enemy. This is our enemy, you know, material desire. We think that our enemies are those who are preventing us from fulfilling our desires or threatening to take away the things that we are enjoying now. That's basically where we think they're out there. But Krishna says, no, the enemy is in here. The enemy is your material desire because it's covering your knowledge. And he calls it kamarupena dushpurena nalenacha. It's this fire that burns. You put fuel in it, right, in the fire. You try to satisfy the fire. But what happens? The fire just burns up more. If you have a fire burning and you take a big a gallon of gasoline, and you just pour it on that fire, for a second or so it'll be doused because it acts like a liquid. But the next second, it's exploding even more, right? And that's what happens with lusty desires. So what's Krishna's prescription? He says, tasmatvam indiyanyado niyamyabhadatarshiva. Now, first of all, he describes that this lust, this material desire, he analyzes it. It's very psychological. There's lusty senses. We know that. You know, that's obvious. You know, if you just got to have a piece of chocolate cake, you know, we can make it neutral like that. You know, but people are addicted, or a cigarette, or this, or that, or something, right? They're compelled to go and try to satisfy some desire. So many different varieties. So that's the senses. But there's also the mind, right? All of these ideas about and memories of previous desires. You want to do it again, right? That's also a repository of lust. And the intelligence. So many plans. So many, you know, ways of figuring out how you can fill the desires of the mind and senses. So Krishna says this lust resides in the senses and the mind and also the intelligence. So this enemy has taken over all the strategic places. We're kind of helpless. So he says, but still, you have to, in the beginning of any spiritual practice, you have to control this lust. You have to control the senses. Tasma indriyanya niyamya bhadatarshapa means control. And this way, conquer the enemy known of lust. And then in the last verse, you know, he analyzes. He said, well, there's a hierarchy here. The intelligence is supposed to control the mind, and the mind is supposed to control the senses. Well, what does the intelligence get its strength and its understanding and will how to control? From above, from the supersoul. But we can't access the supersoul. Okay, we go to the books. The supersoul, Krishna has come externally as these books and as the guru. You know, as the teachers. That's where you can strengthen the intelligence and control. So he's saying, Evam Buddha Putam Buddha, thus by your strong intelligence, you know, knowing yourself to be transcendental to the mind, senses, and even the intelligence, you the soul, or transcendent, control the lower self by the higher self. Well, that's not so easy. It involves yoga. And so then the next chapter, Krishna says, I spoke this yoga by which you can control the lower self. Way back when, to the sun god, millions of years ago. But by the force of time, it's become confused and dissipated, so I'm speaking it again. And he speaks the fourth chapter like that, and Bhagavad Gita goes on. So how does that bring us to this verse? Well, kama in and of itself is not bad. Just like a gun is not bad. But it can be bad if it's used in the wrong way. So kama can also be used in Krishna's service. If it's controlled, and it's used, of course, for propagating nice children. All of our acharyas, you know, they had parents. You know, so it's not an evil thing. Sex is not evil. But it's very dangerous. Like fire, it has to be carefully handled. Otherwise, it'll burn you. It'll cover you. Okay, any questions on this verse? Yes?
What do they mean by passion?
Okay. Passion and desire. Okay. So the word in the Sanskrit is... Well, kama, it says passion, and raga. Really, what he means there is that it's devoid of this tendency. Of course, there has to be desire, but it's controlled, and so it doesn't overwhelm one. You know, there's what we call the different modes of nature, and one of the modes is the mode of passion or rajoguna. You know, and in that mode, this kama is very prominent. It's characterized by unlimited desires and very, obsessive activity to fulfill those desires. What we call like a type A personality, always driven to work. Why only 8 hours? Why not 18 hours? You know, get more money, I can fulfill more desires. That's called passion. So, obviously there has to be desire there, but if it's controlled, then it's said to be dharmic. It's religious. You know, that's the idea. Okay? Okay. All right, let's go on. Now he's giving a general principle. He just said a few things, a few examples of how he's present in all these things. Now we'll give a general principle. Ye chaiva sattvika bhava rajasas tamasas chaye matta eveti tan vidhi natvaham teshu te mahi. No. That all states of being, be they of goodness, passion, or ignorance, are manifested by my energy. I am in one sense everything, but I am independent. I am not under the modes of material nature, for they, on the contrary, are within me. Purport. Excuse me. All material activities in the world are being conducted under the three modes of material nature. Although these material modes of nature are emanations from the Supreme Lord Krishna, he is not subject to them. For instance, under the state laws, one may be punished, but the king, the lawmaker, is not subject to that law. Similarly, all the modes of material nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance, are emanations from the Supreme Lord Krishna. But Krishna is not subject to material nature. Therefore, he is nirguna, which means that these gunas, or modes, although issuing from him, do not affect him. That is one of the special characteristics of Bhagavan, or the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, very important point. These modes are conducting the material energy. And when we artificially separate ourselves from Krishna, we forget him willfully in order to try to exploit the material energy, we come under those modes. Means that our mind is affected by them. Sometimes it's said, deha samudvavam, that these modes arise out of the body. Also, just having a material body means we're plugged into material energy, and therefore we're going to be subject to the modes. So, but Krishna is the source of all these modes. He's not affected by them. Obviously, that's what it means to be this name Achyuta. You know, Achyuta means to fall or to fall down. So Krishna is always Achyuta, means he never falls under the control of the material energy. He's the creator of it, you see. Now, the important point here is that if we become Krishna conscious, we also transcend the modes. You become like what you meditate on, you know. And Krishna pulls us out of the modes. In a couple of verses here, we're going to read a very key verse, Daiviyesha Gunamayi Mama Maya Dorotaya, that this energy of mine is divine. The whole point of this exercise, these last four verses, is that all of this is divine because it's connected to the divine. You know, it's we who treat it in a non-divine way. You know, mundane, you know, profane way, by trying to separate it from the divine. But everything, it's all divine. So he said, "Daiviyesha gunamayi mama mayana." It's divine. But you cannot escape from the clutches of these modes of nature on your own. But those who surrender to me easily cross beyond it. And he'll describe in the 14th chapter the symptoms of those who transcend the modes and how to transcend the modes. Basically, it's by uninterrupted, unmotivated devotional service. So this is our this is a key idea for us. In other words, we're not hopeless here. We're not without a plan, you know, how we can escape from this entrapment. First, we have to recognize it for what it is. We have to recognize that we're in, you know, a prison house here. You know, we may think that it's nice sometimes. So then we're in the we have the golden shackles on. Sometimes it's very horrible. You know, we may see others suffering like that, or we may also suffer, and then we're in solitary confinement or being tormented by them. But either way, whether you're in golden shackles or iron shackles, you're still in the shackles. That's the first recognition. And then we need to recognize how we can get out, and we have to have the determination to actually do that, which will be described in a couple of verses here. So the general principle here is that there are all these different varieties of things going on under the modes of nature. They are under the control of Krishna. He's not controlled by them. That's what this is all about. Okay. Any questions on this? Oh, this principle of nirguna. This is nirguna means no qualities. Now, the impersonalists like to say, you see, it says that the Absolute has no qualities, therefore we're right. It's just an undifferentiated Brahman. But we understand that nirguna means no material qualities. You know, Krishna has all kinds of qualities, but they're not under the modes of nature. They're not our kind of qualities. They're spiritual qualities. The same thing is there for, we've just, a few verses, I think we, this idea of arupa, that he has no form. He has no form like us. He has a spiritual form. You know, that's the origin of all form. He's the origin of all qualities. Our qualities are just borrowed. They're reflecting the original qualities of Krishna. Whatever we have in terms of strength or attractiveness or wealth, you know, or anything, is simply a little infinitesimal part of the infinite attractiveness and the wealth of Krishna. And because we are, you know, within the material world, all of these opulence are very fleeting. We have strength today, tomorrow we have some wealth today, tomorrow it goes. Beauty today, oh, it's tied in with the youth. How long does that last? You know, it's very fleeting. So if we want to be in our permanent state, you know, reflecting our true nature, which is to share in Krishna's opulences, we have to practice this yoga, this bhakti yoga, link up again. We have to plug in again, you know, and live on that platform of eternity. And we can discover our real form and our real function, our real activities in relation to Krishna. So that's what he's describing here. And now he's going to go on with that, how no one knows him because he's beyond the modes of nature. Yes, Prabhu?
You were speaking about how the modes emanate from Krishna, yet he's not affected by them. Can you expand just a little bit on the modes themselves?
Yeah, they're called modes. I like to give the example of musical modes, right? They have minor mode and major mode. Now, minor mode, you know, I remember from my days of playing music, actually as in a band and in an orchestra. So minor mode, you know. It sets kind of a down, a little bit down, you know. It's kind of a more serious thing. Now, there's many ragas. They're also, you know, have different. But the major mode is da 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 la 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 la. Little up, you see. So if you listen to music in a minor mode all the time, then you'll become a little more serious about things. You know, it'll affect you, right? And the ragas, more refined type of music, they can, you know, awaken specific emotions. They're meant to be played at certain times of day or certain times of the year. The rainy season, you know, maybe you want something more upbeat for the rainy season because it's kind of dreary. You're always indoors and it's raining all the time, you know. I'm not sure how they, you know, the science of music. But the point is that it's just a combination of notes, but it has a certain effect on you. It's in a certain mode. So similarly, Everything we do is in a certain mode. The kind of foods we eat, the kind of music we listen to, the people we like to hang out with. And the modes are the symptoms of those modes are given in some detail here, and more detail in the Bhagavatam. Though, if you hang out, if you associate with people who are really, into making money, planning how to make a lot of money, and enjoy, and they idealize, this is another thing: who you idealize, who you want to emulate, very wealthy people who are living a very luxurious life, then that'll be the mode that you're in. And you'll be attracted to that. And you'll also want to do that, right? Now, if you happen to be among people who are very philosophically inclined, who like to study books on philosophy, who maybe are into, meditating in general, being calm, going in the country, getting away from the city, which is by nature in the mode of passion, means that there's always activity, making money, doing things, then you'll become like those people. You'll be more interested in those things. So if you are always around music, that is say Mozart. I mean, I was fortunate. I feel fortunate. I had classical music playing in my house. Do they even have any classical music stations playing anymore on the radio? It's very rare, isn't it? In my day, growing up in the 50s and the 60s, there's several in the New York area. Might always be playing that, put the records on. So it has a certain effect. It's not totally spiritual, but it's at least a little uplifting. So they are, and certain foods, or ways of eating. If you're always stuffing yourself, you get tired more, you develop disease. That's mode of ignorance, Whereas if you eat a little healthy food, you have vigor. So all of this stuff affects us in different modes. So if we know the science, then we'll cultivate the mode of goodness, because in that mode, this knowledge expands. You become more interested in these things. You're more receptive to the transcendental knowledge coming there. So it's like anything else. It's a science. If you want to progress, you need to know the do's and don'ts. Okay, let's go on to this 13th verse, which is very important. 13 and 14 kind of work together. Did we chant the Sanskrit? I don't think we did. Tribhir gunamaya bhavar ebik sarv midam jagat Mohitam nabi janati mame byak padamabhyam. Do you have the right page? It's okay? Okay. Thank you for coming, by the way. deluded by the three modes, goodness, passion, and ignorance, the whole world does not know me, who am above the modes and inexhaustible. This word abhyam is the most often used word in the Bhagavad Gita. You look at it, it's described the soul and Krishna oftentimes. Abhyam, inexhaustible, or doesn't decay at all. Purport, the whole world is enchanted by the three modes of material nature. Those who are bewildered by these three modes cannot understand that transcendental to this material nature is the Supreme Lord Krishna. Every living entity under the influence of material nature has a particular type of body and a particular type of psychological and biological activities accordingly. There are four classes of men, people, functioning in the three material modes of nature. Those who are purely in the mode of goodness are called the Brahmins. Those who are purely in the mode of passion are called the Kshatriyas. Those who are in the modes of passion, both passion and ignorance, are called Vaishyas. Those who are completely in ignorance are called Shudras. And those who are less than that are animals or animal life. However, these designations are not permanent. I may be either a Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or whatever. In any case, this life is temporary. But although life is temporary and we do not know what we are going to be in the next life, by the spell of this illusory energy, we consider ourselves in terms of this bodily conception of life, and we thus think that we are American, Indian, Russian, or Brahmin, Hindu, Muslim, etc. And if we become entangled with the modes of material nature, then we forget the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is behind all these modes. So Lord Krishna says that living entities deluded by these three modes of nature do not understand that behind the material background is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There are many different kinds of living entities, human beings, demigods, animals, etc. And each and every one of them is under the influence of the material nature. And all of them have forgotten the transcendent personality of Godhead. Those who are in the modes of passion and ignorance, and even those who are in the mode of goodness, cannot go beyond the impersonal Brahman conception of the absolute truth. They are bewildered before the Supreme Lord in his personal feature, which possesses all beauty, opulence, knowledge, strength, fame, and renunciation. When even those who are in goodness cannot understand, what hope is there for those in passion and ignorance? Krishna consciousness is transcendental to all these three modes of material nature. And those who are truly established in Krishna consciousness are actually liberated. So, have you ever heard of Plato's cave? Have you ever read any Plato, Socrates? It's very illuminating. I remember early on, there was an article written by Hayagriva Babu, the first editor. I think it was written by him in Back to Godhead magazine. This is our magazine. Because it was such a telling analogy, and really very well may have been influenced by Eastern thought, because the Greeks are right there, you know, between the East and the West. They're kind of the Near East, sort of. And there was some influences coming in from the India. In any case, what this analogy is exactly what's being described here. And he describes, this is spoken by Socrates, you know, in his dialogues. He says, imagine a cave. And in that cave, there are these unfortunate people. And they're chained, you know, and all they can do is see. Behind them is a fire, and there are shadows being projected on the wall in front of them. And that's all they know of reality. It's a very depressing scene, you know. But, you know, that's it. So they said, whoa, that's a pretty bright one. We didn't see one like that yesterday, you know. And there's this going on, and they have this whole thing. But it's very, like, restricted understanding of reality. So one day, one of these fellows broke out of the chains, and he got out of the cave, and he went out into the sunlight, you know. And it was a forest out there, you know. First, he couldn't see. He was blinded by the light, naturally. But after a while, he adjusted to the light, and they were the whole different world. You know, there's birds, and there's animals, and fruit trees, and, you know, the sun. And all of this was new. So he's just amazed, you know, at the variety of things going on out there. So after a day of this, he went back in. He was very eager to tell his friends that, you know, this is not reality here. This is just a pale shadow of it. There's a whole other world out there. But they didn't want to hear it. They didn't believe him. They thought he was crazy, you know, because this is all they knew of reality. And Socrates goes into all kinds of things like that. So this is kind of what we're faced with. The person who wrote this book, who's in the long line of realized souls, Srila Prabhupada, who's the founder of this movement, the scales had come off, you know. In other words, he was able to perceive the reality. And the reality is that this world is just a shadow world, just like that cave. We're not seeing each other now. We're seeing the external body, you know, which is not us. We're the spirit inside. We're the consciousness. But we can't see that. We see effects of it, obviously motion and desire and love and hate and all these things. We see that reflected through the body and how it works. But the body itself is just a big covering on the soul. It's really a restriction of the soul. What to speak of what's called the spiritual world, the world where everything is made of pure spirit, pure consciousness, and the basic nature there is eternity, unlimited knowledge, and bliss. You know, we don't even know what bliss is. We call, you know, some intense sense gratification bliss, but that's not bliss. You know, really deep, unending happiness. You know, so there is a whole world of which this is a reflection. That's a basic principle. It's explicitly mentioned in the 15th chapter. So we're struggling here. By nature, we want that eternity. No one likes to die. No one likes to be sad. No one likes to be in ignorance. We're striving in this world for happiness. We're striving to preserve our life as long as possible in a healthy state. And we want to increase our knowledge, you know. But we're crippled in that effect. We cannot achieve it on the material plane. Every happiness has its misery. And our bodies are just machines growing old, and they'll die eventually. We cannot have eternal life. So that Satchitananda life, that eternal blissful life full of knowledge, is there in the kingdom of God, the kingdom of Krishna. And when we, you know, give up our fascination with this reflection, this phantasmagoria, And we become fascinated with the reality which is being revealed to us in books like Bhagavad Gita. Then we can begin to progress out of this labyrinth or this prison house, whoever you want. And the means is given to us in this age, the yogic means. And it's chanting. Remember, I mentioned how the mind, you know, saturated with these material desires, is our worst enemy. The enemy has taken over the mind, and you know. So we need to somehow fill the mind or redirect the mind, the attention to the transcendence, and that's coming in the form of the holy name. This chanting, is it? The tools that we have to contemplate these ideas are blunted and imperfect because of our saturation in the modes of nature. So we need something that's beyond, that's pure, that's transcendental and divine. And that's the entry of the holy name. So by this chanting of this mantra, this Hare Krishna mantra, all of these things begin to make sense. And we can get a taste of the reality. And if we progress nicely on that, it reveals more and more and more. Krishna reveals more and more. That's the fact. Otherwise, you know, the problem is we're trying to understand these things with an intelligence and a mind that's in the modes of nature. You can't understand it. It's inconceivable. But it's a reality, and that faith in it is what is coming from these statements here. So let's just, we're going a little over time. I want to read Krishna book also. So Prabhupada is talking about, basically, there's different classes of people who are different under different modes of nature. But whatever it is, it's temporary. You know? Whatever we are now, it's temporary. So, but we're all human beings. So whether we're Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Shudras, old, young, male, female, doesn't matter. As long as we have a brain, and we have a mind and intelligence, and we can chant and we can hear, we can progress in devotional service and transcend these modes and transcend these designations, which are artificial for us. That's the whole idea here. But time is wasting. In other words, we have a great opportunity as human beings. And this one verse is always nice to remind us of this one. I think you know this one. Labdva sudurlabha midam bahu sambhavande manushyam artadam anityam api adhira turnam yateta napateta namitya yavat niksheyasaya vishayakala sarvataksyat. So he says, we've attained the human form of life after many, many, many births in other species, you know, other situations. Maybe human, maybe subhuman, whatever. But now here we are in the human form. Bahu sambhavante, many births. Manushyam, same word, human form as a man, mankind. Artadam, this form of life, gives the value, the ultimate need of the soul, which is to escape from the bonds of birth and death and go back to the kingdom of Krishna. So artadam, but it's temporary like every other form. So one has to be dhira, one has to be sober-minded, one has to consider properly. And if one is fortunate to be in touch with pure instruction, then turnam yateta, strive immediately. Don't waste any time, because we're in this illusory kingdom. We can easily take our mind away. So turnam yateta, napateta namrityavat, as long as the body is still alive and is subject to death at any moment, anumrityavat. For what? Strive for what? For nikshayasa, the ultimate good, the ultimate benefit of the soul. Because vishaya, the sense gratification, is available in all species. We've already experienced it. And in another verse on that vein, Krishna himself speaking, nirdeham adyam sulabham sudurlabham plavam sukalpam gurukarnadaram mayanukulena nabasviteritam puman bhavabdin nataretsa atmaha. That nirdeham, the human body, is like a nicely constructed boat to ply over the ocean of birth and death. This world is like, it's like an ocean. It's a dangerous place. So, but we have a nice boat. But any kind of boat needs favorable winds. It's a old sailboat like they had. So those favorable winds are the Vedas, this Vedic instruction coming, Bhagavad Gita and other books, you see. But we also need a captain. And that captain is the spiritual master or the guru. So with all of these facilities, the good boat, the good instruction, the captain, if we don't go over the ocean of birth and death, we're committing spiritual suicide. Atmaha. And we have to keep going round and around until we come to our senses. Any discussion on these points? Tomorrow or Monday we'll read 14. Okay. Hare Krishna. So now we will read a little bit of Krishna book for a few minutes. This is a book, the official title, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and it's a translation of the 10th canto of the Bhagavad Purana. The Bhagavad Purana is one of 18 Puranas. It's the essence of all Vedic truth and knowledge in it. And this specifically talks about or describes the lila or pastimes that Krishna performed when he came to earth 5,000 years ago. So I didn't put this in here. We're still in the intro, I believe, the preface. Where are we here? Okay. Well, consciousness is an art. The art of focusing.